We actually did it in the internal shear that we have in the Beit Midrash on Friday. We covered the basics of it for an hour then, and didn't cover a lot of what we're going to be getting to today. So this is a very big topic, and I'm glad that we had the preparation time for it. Our topic is indeed, for those who are joining now and were not here for the preparation, the topic of Otzer Beis Din, which I will explain momentarily. But first, I wanted to thank the Seder Boker group for dedicating the Yarchei Kala this morning in honor of Rabbi Moshe Harris, the great leader of our Seder Boker program, builder, teacher, director, all the titles in one. As I said to the Seder Boker group themselves when we began this morning, I'm grateful to Rabbi Harris as I like to say as often as I can, because really he does tremendous, tremendous work on an ongoing basis to build the group, to keep the group going, to teach Torah, and to build community and chevra among the group. But also I'm grateful to the group themselves for the way that they've stuck with it through COVID, when we had partial in person, didn't have partial in person, and so on, and now in lockdown. It's a wonderful thing. And I look forward to being able to learn again in the same physical space with you, b'sha'a tova u'mutzlachas, at the right time. So, Otzer Beis Din. Shemitah is a wonderful, wonderful blessing for the Jewish people as a whole. It's a year to focus on spirituality, not because of a pandemic, but because God says to. It's a year to not be involved in controlling and owning and creating in the land, but to cede that control to Hashem and to recognize humbly that it all comes from Hashem. It's a year when we focus on the good of the state as a whole and open up our fields and open up our property for the nations, that people are able to come in and get food, whatever happens to be growing there. I'm just posting the link for the source sheet in the chat in case anyone who's joined does not yet have it. And it's an opportunity for the land itself to rest and to be rejuvenated. And there's a lot to be said in that regard. It's a wonderful thing. The problem with Shemitah, unfortunately, is, you know, hunger. The fact that when you're not able to cultivate, when you're not able to grow things, potentially people go hungry. And so the question is, what can you do about that? And even though in the Torah we are told that there will be a blessing Hashem will send such that the land will produce for us, nonetheless, historically, there have been times when that didn't happen. And the commentators discuss why it didn't happen. Is it that the bracha is only when Shemitah is biblical, not when it's rabbinic? Is it that the blessing in the land is uniquely applicable if everybody's keeping Shemitah perfectly, and if we're not keeping it perfectly, then it will not protect us? Is it because of sins of people in other areas? All sorts of different explanations, which at the end come down to the same thing, which is there is a need for the nation to be able to have food during Shemitah. And so the rabbis have looked for ways to be able to protect the nutritional needs of the Jewish people during Shemitah. One approach is, of course, the well-known heter mechira, the idea of selling the land, and that's not our discussion at all this morning. It may well be what we'll discuss in a Yarchei Kala program on Family Day. Wait and see. But the topic for this morning is the Otzer Beit Din tactic. A tactic which is relevant not only in Israel, but outside of Israel, because, God willing, in a couple of years, the LCBO will be carrying Shemitah wines marked Otzer Beit Din. We may see Esrogim that come in that are Otzer Beit Din, and we're going to need to know what the status is of the wine, what the status is of the Esrogim. So that's what we're going to tackle. I'd say probably about 60 to 70% of this is going to be about the issue on the side of the Beit Din and how they run this. In other words, just philosophy, how this works, and the practical questions that face the Beit Din in running it. And the rest of it is going to be about the consumer and what we need to know as consumers. In the first link on the source sheet, and I'm going to repost the link in the chat, in the first link on the source sheet, the first source on the source sheet, I gave you a link to the shiur that I gave on this topic of Otzer Beit Din on Friday, which provides a lot of background material, and it is more full than some of the discussion that we're going to get to today. So people who want more information can click that tiny CC link and get the and get that. But here's where I want to go with this today. Number one, what is Otzer Beit Din and how does it work? Then, one limitation, what kind of produce is able to, is covered in Otzer Beit Din? What kind of produce can we access through Otzer Beit Din? Then, what powers does the Beit Din have to cultivate this produce, to hire people to work on this produce? What may the Beit Din pay for and collect for financially? Meaning, Beit Din is going to pay people to do work. What exactly are they able to pay for, and what are they able to demand from the consumer? What are they able to demand that the consumer pay for? And then finally, the produce retains sanctity of Shemitah, and that's going to affect the how we use this this produce. Are we clear so far just on what we're doing, where we're going, what this is about? Okay. So, first of all, the words Otzer Beit Din. An Otzer is what?
Treasury,
storage area, right? Warehouse, really, for our purposes. It is a storage area controlled by a Beit Din, by a rabbinical court. We'll have to talk about what kind of rabbinical court. But that's the concept. So I gave you a couple of questions in the first section of the source sheet, which hopefully you had a chance to cover. But basically, we say that we're not allowed to harvest and distribute Shemitah produce normally. If you had a well-intentioned farmer who said, you know, during Shemitah, it's ridiculously inefficient for me to open up my field, let people march in, take what they want. It doesn't get the produce to everybody. It doesn't get the produce to the needy people. I think I'd like to do things a little differently. I think what I want to do is collect all my produce and distribute it to the needy people myself. I'm going to lock the door to the field. No one else can come in. Lock the door to my orchard. And I'm going to collect it and I'll distribute it. And I'm going to follow all the rules. I'm not going to keep it myself. I'm not going to make money on it. Does that work? Is that allowed during Shemitah? The answer is no. The answer is no. The Sifra says that explicitly, that you're not allowed to do it. The Rambam talks about it. That is a no-no. Individual owners of fields are not allowed to take care of this. I brought you the Rambam in source number one on the sheet, which says you're not allowed to harvest produce in the way that you normally harvest it. That will be one of the problems. Another problem is that you're keeping people out of the field. That's not allowed. As Rosh Shlomo Zalman Orbach says in source number two, the rule for Shemitah produce, the way that we engage with Shemitah produce, is that we have to let everybody have access to it. Rav Shlomo Zalman points out a unique aspect of Shemitah produce. Shemitah produce is identified as being hefker. Hefker normally means ownerless. Nobody has a right to it. However, he says that's not the nature of Shemitah produce. The nature of Shemitah produce is that everybody has a right to it. Rafal, you're laughing. Everybody has a right to it. It's sort of ersatz hefker. Everyone's the owner, not no one's the owner. But the result of that is that I can't harvest, I can't keep people out, and I'm not allowed to be the one to distribute the produce, even for its own protection. So Beis Din comes up with the following suggestion in source number three. This is a Tosefta. Tosefta generally records material from the period of the Tanaim, the sages of the Mishnah, that didn't make it into the Mishnah for a variety of reasons. Sometimes it didn't make it into the Mishnah because it was deemed redundant. Sometimes it's because Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, Rebbe, did not have access to it. And in some cases, it's actually reflective of something that's from just after the Mishnah, because Tosefta is not canonized at the same time. Tosefta is canonized a little bit later. I'm going to take a look at source number three, where the Tosefta says, and I'm going to read out my English translation in general for sources in the interest of time, because we're trying to fit an awful lot into this conversation. At first, court agents sat at the entrance to cities. for anyone who brought produce in hand, meaning people would bring produce to these rabbis, they took it from, or their agents, they took it from him, but they gave him 3 meals worth. So you bring produce to the rabbinical court, that already is a red flag. Why are they able to collect produce in that way? Where are you able to harvest the produce in that way? And they give you 3 meals worth. That's all you're getting. And then they put the rest into the storehouse. The time comes for harvesting figs. The court agents hire workers who collect the figs. They make fig cakes, put them in barrels, put them in the city storehouse. And that's another red flag. They're processing these figs in ways that normally you're not allowed to process Shemitah produce. The fig cakes are actually a problem. Then the time came for grapes, and again, they would process the grapes, they would do all this collection, and then they would distribute the produce every Friday. Each person gets based on the household needs. So that's their way to deal with this problem, and in fact, it seems to be in the Yerushalmi as well. I didn't bring the Yerushalmi here, but there's a Yerushalmi which we referenced in the longer shir that's at the top of the source sheet as well. Ramban mentions this as well. Ramban Nachmanides in source number 4, in his comments to the Torah of Parshas Behar, that's where you look. If you want to know about Shemitah, Shemitah appears in a bunch of places in the Torah, but the Ramban in Parshas Behar is a critical source for knowing a lot of the aspects of Shemitah. And he mentions this practice of preparing storehouses in each city and being able to then collect and distribute the produce. So far, so good. I want to refer you back to the beginning of this section on the source sheet where I asked you two questions. Question number 1, does this sound like a commercial proceeding? I should know, because someone just sent me a message in the chat. Usually I mention this in the beginning, but I had too many things to mention in the beginning, so I forgot to. Please don't send me messages in the chat. Ask your questions out loud, if at all possible, unless your speaker isn't working.
It is a commercial proceeding.
Yeah.
But, and I said this to our group, Rabbi, it is a very communist-oriented for 1 year proceeding, but you can say it is a commercial socialist/communist proceeding.
It is a commercial socialist/communist proceeding. So it's definitely has...
transactional, not commercial.
Ah, that's a good distinction. Chaim makes a distinction of commercial versus transactional, right? It is definitely socialist/communist. In other words, we are enforcing a system in which whatever you produce is going to now be distributed to everybody else by this overseeing body. But the distinction that Chaim points out between commercial and transactional is important here. It is a transaction. You bring your stuff, they give you a little bit of it, and then they're going to distribute it as they see fit to everybody else. How would commercial be different from transactional, Chaim?
There's no attempt at profit here, and there's no hint of profit here.
Mm-hmm. There's no profit involved, so tell me something. What does that mean? When you say there's no profit here in the description of Otzer Beit Din, what does that mean to you?
It means that's not one of the goals of this of the transaction. There are other goals other than profit, individual or group profit here.
How do you know that?
Because there's no money. There's no attempt at sale.
There's no money changing hands. There's no description at all of any money changing hands. Right? It is a transaction. But there's no sale at all. Now, this is not the way it's done today. The way it's done today is that the Beit Din actually tends to hire the farmers themselves to take care of the trees, to take care of the grapevines, and to do the harvesting. Then they deliver the produce to the Beit Din, and the Beit Din distributes it to people. How in the world can they afford to hire these farmers? They charge the customer for labor and for costs, but not for the fruit. That's the way Otzer Beit Din actually is in operation today. But we pointed out here that even if you're not paying for the fruit itself, there are all sorts of problems. There's harvesting going on. There's processing going on. Something is wrong here. How is it that Beit Din is empowered to actually do this? What enables them to carry out this proceeding? So that's something that we're going to have to talk about in our next section here. Well, in 2 sections from now. The first thing we have to do now that we know what Otzer Beit Din is and what it looks like, is to ask the question of which produce is covered under that. Did the different groups get to this part in the prep time? Okay. So some, I see some heads nodding. That's good. I know that the Seder Boker group got to it. I see the Sutner Deanna group got to it. Okay. All right. So you saw got to it also with Rav Alex. Good. So the question is, what kind of produce is actually covered here? And I might have expected that you could use this method for basically anything. You could use this method with whatever grows, but it's not true. And the reason why it's not true is because of a rabbinic decree called Isser Sfichin. And to make a long story short, and the Rambam here in source number 5 does a nice job of that, we have a rabbinic decree that seems to undermine much of what Shemitah was meant to accomplish. In the sense that my vision of Shemitah, if I didn't know this Rambam, would be, so everybody goes into people's fields, and they see there's wild stuff growing, and they pick it, and they take it home and eat it. Lo and behold, the Rambam informs us, it's not his invention, of course, it comes from the Gemara, that there is a prohibition against using produce that grows wild during Shemitah. Against Svichin. The reason being, because human beings are human beings, and if you were allowed to use that which grows wild during Shemitah, how long would it be before people would start planting things and pretending that they grew wild? So in order to prevent that, they said, no, no, no. Anything that is normally cultivated and therefore could anything that is normally cultivated and could have been planted during Shemitah is off limits even if it grows wild. The only things I'm allowed to take from what grows wild during Shemitah are tree fruit, and we include grapes within that discussion. And the reason there is why. Why is tree fruit okay? Why is tree fruit okay?
Comes back every year. It's not
planted. Yeah. Well, it actually comes back every year. You can't plant it that year. Good luck planting trees during Shemitah in order to get fruit that year. That ain't happening. Aside from Arla, it's just not happening. So so that's not a concern. And that which always grows wild, which people don't plant in general, is also okay. So that's all you're going to get with your Otzer Beit Din tactic, is year 7 vegetables that always grow wild and tree fruit. Note that you won't get year 6 produce, because year 6 produce belongs to the farmer, and when the Beit Din says to him, hey, we'd like you to turn this over to us, the farmer says, thanks but no thanks, this has no status of Shemitah produce, I'm going to keep this for myself. Okay, so now we get to our second limitation, which is the powers of the rabbinical court beyond the harvesting thing, but the guarding, the processing, the hiring, and all of that. And we asked, what two ways are proposed here to understand what the Beit Din is able to do? So we've got source number 7 and source number 8 that we needed to see here. In source number 7, the Rashbash, Rabbi Shlomo Duran, how did he explain why the Beit Din can do what it does? What was his answer?
It was similar to the innovation of the
Otzar. No, I'm asking, what is it that allows the Otzar Beit Din to do what it does? What does Rabbi Duran think? What is it that empowers them? I bolded it in the Hebrew, in source number 7.
The Yad Aniyim.
Right, Yad Aniyim. The fact that they are agents of the needy. That's Rabbi Duran's position. Rabbi Duran, also known as the Rashbash, says that that they are the arm of the needy, and that gives them special powers that they are able to take care of the produce. It's very interesting. The background on Rabbi Duran's response to him is very interesting. He is in 15th century Algeria, as I noted on the sheet, but he receives a set of questions from Jerusalem, and this is one of the questions they asked him. They said, we are observing Shemitah, 15th century Yerushalayim, and we have a problem, which is our non-Jewish neighbors see that we leave our fields open and our orchards open, and they're going to come take everything. Could we actually guard our produce so that we're going to have something to eat? and that's where his response comes in. He says, yeah, use the Otzer-Beistin method. That's his recommendation. He says the court functions as an arm of the population, and that's how they're able to pull this off. That's one approach. The other approach is the approach of the Chazon Ish, Rabbi Avraham Yeshaya Karelitz in source number 8. Did anybody see that and can tell me what he says? What's his view of how this works? Rafal, you're muted.
Matter of ownership.
Yes, for the benefit of the owners.
Right. He says the issue is ownership. So if the Beit Din, the rabbinical court, is not the owner of this produce, they are allowed to perform these actions. The issue is don't demonstrate ownership. This fits with an idea that Rav Shaul Yisraeli stated. There's a classic problem with Otzer Beit Din, which is, it appears in that Tosefta that we read. Ramban mentions it, but the Rambam doesn't mention it at all. The Rambam, in his code of law, gives you all these laws for Shemitah. He doesn't mention Otzer Beit Din at all. Does that mean he disagreed? Some say yes. Some say he held that Otzer Beit Din was only for a particular moment in history, or that the Tosefta does not actually reflect halacha. However, if you take a look back at source number 6, Rabbi Yisraeli says, the reason why the Rambam didn't say anything is because it's not particularly novel. The issue is, during Shemitah, don't act as an owner. The rabbinical court is not acting as an owner of the field. They are non-owners. Therefore, it's okay. That's the other approach. This is really, really important, this distinction, because it informs a lot of what the Beit Din wants to do. Number one, is the Beit Din allowed to hire the farmers to work in their own fields? Tell me something. Why would you want to hire the farmer to do the work in his own field?
He'll do it better.
He'll do it better, right. I mean, he knows the stuff. He has all the equipment in place. He's going to be more efficient. That's one reason to do it. Why else would you want to hire the farmer?
Not only is it to do it better, he's more interested. He's a better crop out of it.
He's more interested in getting a better crop. Okay, although you could argue that hungry people in general are pretty invested. Yes, Dan?
No, I have a question.
Okay, so I'll hold off on the question. What's another reason why it makes sense to hire the farmer?
He's the one losing the money during
He's the one who's losing the money, Nafti says. He's the one who's giving you also the produce, right? In other words, there has to be an incentive for him to join this thing. The incentive is he knows he's going to get paid to work in the field. That's a big, big incentive for him, as opposed to open your doors, let everybody else come in and do the work and gather the stuff, and they can get paid, and you got nothing. So that's another incentive for hiring the farmer. Dan, what was your question going to be?
I heard a couple of times already that Rambam ignored this because, I don't know, it didn't fit exactly what he was writing. But he knew that tens of times, I mean, almost never, the Shemitah was observed. It's a big problem. Why would he ignore it?
Yeah. Now, the answer that the Rabbi Yisraeli gives, I must admit, troubles me also. The Rambam is not shy about mentioning things and throwing things in, even things that are not strictly speaking halachic, and this in truth really is. Nonetheless, that's Rav Yisraeli's approach. If you want more approaches to why he omitted it, I'll refer you to that first link on the sheet for the shiur that I gave on Friday. We discussed it in greater depth.
Now, Jeff, yes. What about the fact that Israel can be under foreign rule? And I'm just thinking about commercial versus transactional. You're talking about amortization. You're talking about debts, reconciliation. There's a lot here.
Right.
So I'm saying, what happens if they're under a foreign rule? You might not be able to do this a la communist dynamic.
So what you're pointing out is accurate and has been an issue at times. The Talmud discusses a case in which farmers need to pay a tax to the Romans. A tax was called arnona, a term that's still used today financially in Israel. So there was a tax that the farmers would have to pay to the Roman government, and the rabbis actually permitted them to work their fields in order to be able to afford to pay the tax. And there's a lot of discussion as to why they allowed that. Was it because Shemitah was only rabbinic at that time? Was it because it was a matter of life and death? But you're right. We don't always have the liberty to be able to do this ourselves and to do it. You're right. This is one of the things we've wrestled with over time.
Expand on Jeff's question a little. The Beis Din nowadays cannot impose fines.
So true.
This is like even more.
They're not imposing a fine.
Taking over the whole thing.
They're not imposing a fine, though. Fines are a very particular limitation. This is not... a fine means I'm taking something from you that you don't owe me. That's not what they're doing here. They're opening their shop, so to speak. They can't force a farmer to bring him the produce, right? If the farmer says, I'm interested in marketing it myself, there's nothing the Beit Din can do, or not marketing, hopefully, but I'm interested in eating, I'm interested in just leaving my field open, whatever it is. Beit Din has no enforcement powers. The farmer can do whatever she wants. It's not up to the Beit Din. Okay. So the issue, I want to go a little further with this, because there's a lot to talk about still. In terms of hiring the farmer, we understand that there are a lot of benefits to doing so. If you take the view of the Rashbash, right? You take that view that the Beit Din is acting on behalf of the needy, that works well, right? You can hire the farmer just as easily. However, if I take the view of Chazon Ish, that the point is not to act like owners, how in the world can you hire the owner to do the work in his or her own field? Harvesting, potentially keeping people out, which is something we have to discuss. How can you do that? And the truth of the matter is, I would think the Chazon Ish should prohibit it. And based on that, Rav Shaul Yisraeli and Rav Mordechai Eliyahu, two leading authorities in Israel, latter half of the 20th century, said, no, you're not allowed to hire the farmer at all. However, in the end, many halachic authorities, and so is brought from the Chazon Ish himself, were lenient and said you could hire the farmer personally for a variety of reasons. Number one, because the farmer is operating under the control of the rabbinical court, he's not really acting in the way that an owner does. The owner runs things himself. She decides what she's going to do. Whereas here, the owner is operating under the control of the Beit Din. That's number one. Number two, this whole thing is meant in part to help people to observe Shemitah. You want to encourage the farmer to observe Shemitah. You tell the farmer, let everybody else do this, and you're getting not a dime. You're less likely to see cooperation, as we noted. Also, as noted, the farmer is the one best able to do the work, and the farmer is the one with the equipment. So in the end, everybody ends up, not everybody, but many end up allowing the farmer to be the one to do the work. But that was one point. Second point, keeping people out of the orchard. I'm reposting the link for the source sheet in the chat because I see people join. Keeping people out of the orchard. That's something that normally you're not allowed during Shemitah. So again, Rabbi Duran, the Rashbash, is going to say, sure, you can keep people out of the orchard. You are the arm of the needy. You have superpowers. Go do it. However, according to the Chazon Ish, keeping people out is the definition of what an owner does, right? Just like a government keeps people out of their country if they believe the person is a threat, the owner of property keeps people off of the land if he thinks that they are a threat. So you shouldn't be allowed to do it. And in fact, it's recorded that the Chazon Ish refused to purchase esrogim that had been in orchards where the public was kept out during Shemitah. Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, student of the Chazon Ish, says, no, you're not allowed to keep other people out at all. He says, it doesn't make any sense that you'd be allowed to keep other people out. And he brings sources to support this. But this is a key debate, whether you're able to keep others out of the field. Third ramification of this is the question of what kind of rabbinical court do we need? If I take the view of the Chazon Ish, which is just don't act as an owner, are there any special qualifications necessary for this Beit Din? The answer is no. Just don't be owners of the field, right? That's the only requirement we have, is don't be an owner of the field. Whereas if I take Rashbash, this Beit Din is acting as the hand of the needy. then maybe I require that it be a Beit Din with status. They have to be an established court if they're going to claim to speak on behalf of the needy of the community. Not unlike Prozbul, which is something we need to discuss at the other end of Shemitah when we get to discussing the forgiveness of loans in Shemitah. Maybe there's a need for a serious rabbinical court. However, Rabbi Shaul Barzam points out a benefit to using a more important court, and this goes back a little bit towards what Dan had pointed out about fining people, which is we're going to see a dispute about what kind of payment the Beit Din is able to demand that people pay for the produce. And there are going to be some pretty severe limitations. However, Rabbi Barzam, who was a student of the Chazon Ish, and I brought him here in source number 10 on the sheet, says, if you get a high-powered rabbinical court, an empowered rabbinical court, one that is a leading institution within the community to be the ones to run this Otzer Beit Din, they may have the authority to demand that people pay more, even though it's not the amount that was necessary for the work done in the field. They could still demand that people pay more because of tzedakah, because a serious rabbinical court can say people are obligated to give a certain amount to help the needy. We're taxing everybody, essentially. So we may want a special Beit Din, even if the Chazon Ish doesn't require it. Nonetheless, maybe you want a special court for that reason. That's in source number 10. So what we've seen so far at this stage is that the Otzer Beit Din will help for tree fruit, for grapes, for that which normally grows wild in your field. And the way it works is that they will hire people to do the work in the field. There's some dispute as to whether they can hire the actual farmer, but the tendency is indeed to let them do that. Some will require that it be a high-level rabbinical court, but the Chazon Ish's view is not necessarily. It could really be any three. As a matter of fact, there are those who suggest that it could be even one person. The only reason we have a rabbinical court at all is to establish a level of oversight and responsibility for it, but really it could have just been any individual, as long as it's not the owner of the field. Are we good so far?
Can I just ask
Morris,
a fundamental question? Is it ownership of the land or ownership of the produce from the land that is what you're trying to avoid?
Ownership of the produce. So acting as owner of the produce.
So you can basically safeguard your land but allow people, let's say, take the produce, take the fruit from the trees, put them in boxes and say, okay, this is Hefker, but don't come onto my land. I don't want you.
So no, that's a separate problem. There is a separate prohibition against blocking access to your land. And that is one of the benefits of Otzer Beit Din, is that because you're not the owner, we're going to let you do this. We're going to let you keep people out. If you were the owner, you would not be allowed to keep people out.
Rabbi, so I have a question. So if the produce is going to be more expensive because of all the administrative costs and everything else, so you're putting a sort of a hardship on the exact people you're trying to help.
Good. We're going to come to that. It's a good question, Ralph. We're just not there yet. But you are 100% right. This is a concern. But just to finish the thought with Morris, this is one of the incentives for farmers to cooperate with Otzer Beit Din, is that where the farmer on his own, on her own, does not have the right to block access, the Beit Din does have the ability to block access.
So without Beit Din, like how do you, like for... protect yourselves against bandits, etc., or in today's terms, you know, people, terrorists, etc., if you can't block access, like, it seems that it's a non-viable situation.
Well, keep in mind, these are your fields. It's not talking about access to your home. But But you're right. And this has been a discussion. There's a lot of literature on this in terms of protecting the trees themselves, and in terms of protecting produce that's not ready. People are allowed to come in and pick the stuff that's ready, but if you have, let's say, esrogim, which stay on the tree for a very long time, you could have esrogim there that should not be picked yet, and are you able to do anything to keep people from picking it is part of this halachic discussion. There's a lot to be said about that. It's a bigger discussion than what we're going to get into right now. But you're right. It is an issue. So let's get into the commercial aspect or transactional aspect, depending on how you want to look at it. There are two concerns when it comes to setting the price for Shemitah produce. Concern number one is called Ha'arama. Concern number two is called Sichora. Ha'arama means what? What does Ha'arama mean?
Trickery.
Trickery. Deception.
Fake out.
Yeah. The concern that we have here is that in the event that you're going to start charging people for this, and you're hiring the farmer, right, and they're paying for the produce, you're not going to be able to distinguish between what happens in a regular year and this. It becomes a scam in which the farmer is running all aspects from the harvesting to the marketing. People are paying just like they do regularly. It looks an awful lot like it's just a scam. We insert baked in here to make it look okay. That's a concern for Ha'arama. Rishal Yisraeli in source number 11 talks about this. He's really, really uncomfortable with this whole thing. He doesn't like the idea of using the farmers themselves. Really doesn't like it. So there are a few different components to this in terms of what you're able to charge for. One question is, can you, as a farmer, charge for the work that you did to cultivate the fruit before Shemitah began? You did stuff, right? You fertilized the tree, you repaired any harm to the tree, you did things in the early stage to keep the fruit safe. Can you, as a farmer, say to the Beit Din, I want to be reimbursed for that? So the Orchos Rabbeinu, which has a lot of material on the Chazon Ish, as well as on the stipler of Yaakov Kanievsky, says the Chazon Ish was not so sure that you could turn around and charge people for cultivation that happened before the Shemitah year. He was not so sure that that should be allowed, and he was very on the fence. He didn't have an answer. He said, I'm not so sure that that should be okay. That really makes it look like a trick, because now you're paying for all of the farmer's work all along. He did say, though, that if the farmer does things that are permitted to take care of the trees during Shemitah, that's okay. So, for example, if you grow tree fruit, you know that if you grow a fruit on the tree and it's next to something that's jutting out from the branch, even if it's just something as small as a leaf, it will dent the fruit. The fruit will get a bruise. The fruit could have a cut in it as a result of that. Farmers are allowed to remove those things that would harm the fruit, even during Shemitah. So he said the farmer can charge for that. That is an okay thing for the farmer to be charging for. The harvesting, clearly, they are charging for. The cost of the harvesting is core to the entire Otzer Beit Din procedure. But what about the cost of irrigation? That's a really interesting question. The farmer irrigates the orchard. Do you think the farmer should be able to pass that along to the community, or is that a concern for Ha'arama? And tell me why. Why might the farmer not be able to pass along the cost of irrigation?
He'll raise the prices.
Okay, new. If that's what it costs, it's what it costs.
He's not just doing it for that year. He's doing it
Right, so Rafal points out what Rabbi Karp points out in source number 12 on the sheet, which is it's really for the farmer's advantage to be irrigating. The farmer wants his field not to die. The farmer wants the trees not to die. It's something he would be doing regardless. So that's his argument. That actually becomes a great debate in various writers, which is really a farming debate of how important is it that you water your trees and how frequently do you need to water them in order to ensure that you're going to actually get fruit this year. But that's one consideration, is the question of the farmer's doing it for himself. It's a scam if you're going to turn around and charge the community for it. Scam is a good translation for Ha'arama.
Sorry, Rabbi, that kind of negates the whole thing, does it not?
What do you mean?
Well, I'm saying that this is 1 year of rest. That means the farmer cannot have any sort of commerce whatsoever on that 1 year.
But if that's true, you may not have fruit. So we're...
Okay, but it goes back to the same thing.
Yes.
Can you rest for a year without any commerce?
So the thing is that irrigation is allowed. Fundamentally, irrigation is allowed. And this is something that in our Friday sessions we're about to actually discuss over the next few weeks. But irrigation normally is allowed because we don't want the land to be ruined. So it would be okay anyway. The only question is, can you charge for it? But the second reason not to is if you were to go back to the original model in that Tosefta, it said nothing about paying people for cultivating the fruit at all. It only talked about collecting from them and distributing it. There was no mention at all of that. So some argue you shouldn't be able to charge for that. However, Rabbi Zev Weitman in source number 13 says that's not a thing. He says that's not an argument. And his reason why it's not a valid argument is, and it's him being quoted here, it's not from his original text, but Rabbi Ehud Achituv is quoting him. He says, that's because the way we farm has changed over time. And he says, the way that they farmed back in the day, they didn't necessarily need great investment in the beginning of the year, and so they didn't account for it in the Tosefta. But today is different. This is necessary for the end product, and therefore we should be able to pass along those costs to the consumer. And as a matter of halakha, that is the way that the halakhic authorities hold. They say the upkeep is considered to be for this year's produce, and this is his job in order to produce the fruit, the farmer's job, and therefore we're going to pay for it. And here Rabbi Barzam comes back in and says, of course you can charge for it. If nothing else, you're just getting the community to pay tzedakah in order to enable the farmer to be able to survive. That's in source number 14. But that's in terms of the ha'arama concern, the deception concern, the scam concern. But there's another issue. As the Talmud says in source number 15 from the Gemara in Avodah Zarah, you are not allowed to engage in commerce. Commerce, the magic word Jeff used before. You're not allowed to engage in commerce with Shemitah produce. So maybe that creates certain restrictions on what you can charge for. Maybe you're not allowed to charge for more than the strict expenses of producing and harvesting and distributing the fruit. And Rabbi Moshe Mordechai Karp made that argument. He says you have to be precise in calculating the expenses. Rabbi Shaul Barzam, in source number 16, said, well, it depends. He says, if you ask me beforehand as they're making their arrangements, yes, they have to keep things as low as possible, and that's it. However, he says, if Beit Din already made the arrangements and now people are complaining that it costs too much, this really isn't called commerce because it's still based on the same structure that we expect for Otzer Beit Din of reimbursing the farmers for their efforts. As long as your structure is one of reimbursal rather than setting a price with a profit margin, you're still okay. That's Rabbi Barzam. He doesn't like it. But he says this can be acceptable. That's source number 16 on your sheet. But then that takes me back to Ralph's point. Ralph asked the question, if you charge more than in normal years, you're actually defeating the whole thing that you're trying to create. Not to mention, now I'll tell you, it looks an awful lot like it is commerce. So that the Chazon Ish, and I brought it for you in source number 17, says what you're supposed to do here. Actually, sorry, I'm not quite ready for number 17 yet. But the statement of the Chazon Ish is that let me take a step back. I'm rushing a little bit, and I want to make sure not to do that. Number one. Rav Moshe Mordechai Karp writes, you need to make sure that it's visible and obvious to everybody that the produce is being treated as ownerless and that it's not being used in a visibly commercial way. And therefore, he argued the price has to be lower than in normal years. If normally it costs me a dollar for this, now it has to cost me 75 cents. The price has to be lower, and without that, you lose the benefits of the Otzer Beit Din. Rabbi Yosef Shalom Al-Yashiv took that stance as well. And the Chazon Ish refused to buy an esrog from Otzer Beit Din when the prices were the same or higher than that of normal years. So you have this strong group of halachic authorities who say the price has to be lower than in a regular year. However, there are others who disagree and say no. Rabbi Yosef Lieberman, in the Mishnas Yosef, brings reasons not to say this. He says, look, there are all sorts of reasons why it might cost more to produce it in a Shemitah year, right? You're not producing things as efficiently as you could, number one. Number two, there's less fruit available on the market. So therefore, the price is going to go up. It's just part of the basic system. Don't blame that on the farmer cheating or the Beis Din cheating the system. It's just the way it is, right? You have certain costs that go into your product, which normally, if you have a lot of product, so it spreads out among each item. However, when you have less product, then those costs necessarily are higher for each individual item. If it costs me $1 million, I'm just making up numbers, obviously. If it costs me $1 million, but I produce 1 million lemons, so it's $1 per lemon. But if it costs me $1 million and I can only produce 250,000 lemons, it's going to be $4 a lemon. That's the way it works. Yes,
so,
Jeff?
Rabbi, what you're saying is no individual should or could benefit from a Shemitah year.
That is correct. They should not come out ahead.
That's right.
Right. That's correct. So the Chazon Ish actually clarifies his position in this regard. He says in source number 17, now I'm ready for number 17, he says the key is that you calculate it based on the effort that goes into it. It's not about making money on the deal. However, you may end up with a higher price, you may end up with a lower price. That's just the way it goes. Now, some did indeed argue, as Ralph said, but you're not helping people if it costs more. And the answer is maybe. That could well be. But others said, so what? That's the way it goes. This is just what, you know, the mechanism we have. Okay. Last area of limitation. Last area of limitation here. We've talked now about what the Beis Din is able to charge for, and that was very important. But now we also have to ask about how they're going to sell the produce. We have two concerns. Concern number one is when you provide your produce out there in the store and there's a sign up saying lemons cost X, that looks an awful lot like a routine sale. That's number one. Number two, you degrade the sanctity of the produce. Shemitah produce is holy. We're going to see there are restrictions on how you're allowed to use Shemitah produce. So Rabbi Yosef Efrati wrote a letter in source number 18 in which he discussed this concern. And he said, Rav Nissim Karelitz, a major halachic authority in Israel, does not allow you to sell Shemitah produce in stores. Oats or Beit Din may not be distributed in a storefront, he said. And then he said, we actually follow Rabbi Eliashiv, who said it's okay to distribute it in stores, but only under certain conditions, which he does not actually name there. In particular, Rav Eyud Achituv notes that you have to be careful not to sell Shemitah produce in stores with non-Shemitah produce, because then the whole thing becomes a farce, and you're going to treat the Shemitah produce the same as the non-Shemitah produce. One concern in particular is whether you're allowed to weigh the Shemitah produce on scales. Is that actually allowed? Did anybody get up to this in the prep time to this point? Okay. So I'll take you through this a little bit more slowly or carefully. If you take a look at source number 19 on the source sheet, the Mishnah says you're not allowed to sell Shemitah produce with volume measures or by weighing it or by counting out each individual one. And the Jerusalem Talmud Yerushalmi, in source number 20 explains why. It says, we don't want you measuring it out with these devices so that they will sell it cheaply. You'll sell it more cheaply if it's not measured precisely, says the Yerushalmi. To which the Talmud then asks, what are you talking about? We can just say, there's a rule, you have to sell it cheaply, but you can still measure it. So the answer that they give is no, because if you let them measure it that way, by weighing it the normal way, then even he will not treat them with sanctity. And those words are not at all clear. What does that mean? three different approaches are brought by the commentators. One approach is to say that the money has to be treated as sacred, and that's something we're going to talk about momentarily. But the money you use, money that is exchanged for Shemitah produce, has to be treated as holy in its own right. And if you buy things the way you normally do with scales, then they'll just treat the money as regular money. That's one concern. Second concern that's mentioned in source number 21, the second bullet point, is that they won't treat the produce with sanctity after weighing it, because it looks just like regular produce. And then the third concern is, no, the act of weighing it in and of itself is degrading to something that is holy. And therefore, this is inappropriate. So this is going to be an issue. You're going to be in Israel, God willing, next year during the Shemitah year. COVID long gone. You travel to Israel. You go to a place where they're providing oats or beit din, and you say, well, look, I was asked to go to the store and get a kilo of cucumbers. Well, cucumbers are not likely to be an oats or beit din, so that's not going to be a thing. But a kilo of peaches, and you're not going to be allowed to weigh it out, according to these commentators. However, Rav Ehud Achituv argues that you can weigh it out. Why? Because he says, in terms of the money, we're going to see that the money may not have Kedusha Shvius, for reasons we're going to get to momentarily. It may not have sanctity. In terms of the produce being treated in a holy way, people will still treat it in a holy way, even if they weigh it. Because they're not buying it, they're just paying for the work. And as far as the concern about weighing being degrading, that's only if you weigh it for sale. People get on scales all the time. They don't find that degrading, unless they don't like the numbers that they see. But otherwise, weighing is not inherently degrading. It's only weighing for sale that is degrading. I realize I rushed through that. I hope that was somewhat clear, but I wanted to spend some time on more of the buyer issues. In other words, we just started on the buyer issues by talking about how the item is sold in the store and weighing it. But now let's talk about the rest of the user end issues. So first of all, there's the issue of Kedusha, the sanctity of the produce. The rule is that if you buy Shemitah produce, or if you exchange something for Shemitah produce, whatever you use to buy it, whatever you exchange for it, gains holiness and can only be used in very limited ways. Cannot be thrown out, cannot be wasted, and so forth. So, I'm sorry?
Where does the product have Kedusha?
By dint of being something that grew in Israel during Shemitah, it has Kedusha. It has holiness. It just because it grew in Israel. That's it.
So any product, all the time?
No, but Shemitah confers a certain degree of sanctity on the item itself. Because it's Shemitah produce.
Just because it was used in a mitzvah?
No. Because it grew during Shemitah. Shemitah produce is inherently holy. You follow? That which grows in Israel during Shemitah is holy. It's not because of anything you did.
Okay.
That's the idea.
It's Shabbat Shalom.
So the question now is, what's the status of the money that you exchange for this? So the argument is that since what you're doing is you're paying for work, you're not buying the produce, you're just paying for the work, therefore the money does not become holy. But that falls apart when you get to the LCBO. Because the LCBO isn't selling it as oats or beit din. The LCBO isn't saying we're turning around and paying those who processed the wine for their act of processing it. They're doing their own commercial transaction using Shemitah produce. So in fact, if you pay with cash when you buy Shemitah wine from the LCBO, the cash now has Kedusha Shvius. Fortunately, most people... I'm sorry?
Even if it's going to a public institution?
Yep. Correct. Doesn't make a difference. It has Shemitah status. Fortunately, there's an easy out. As Rabbi Yaakov Ariel points out, buy it with a credit card. If you buy on credit, you're okay. And the reason why you're okay for buying it on credit is because the credit card company is the one who's paying for the wine, not you. they're paying your debt, effectively. The credit card company finds out you owe the LCBO X amount of money, and then they are the ones who are going to turn around and pay for that. And because they're paying your debt as opposed to buying the product, the money that they spend does not become holy. So pay by credit card if you're buying oats or Beit Din. That's number one.
Can you back that up and say if you pay a farmer for the produce using a credit card, you're not transacting?
So that would seem to be correct. That would seem to be correct. That's number one. Number two is the holiness of the produce itself. And this you can't get around so easily. Meaning, I am not allowed to destroy Shemitah produce. I mentioned that already briefly before, I think. It's a Gemara in Pesachim, Dun Beis, and Mud Beis. As one example, the Rambam in source number 22 mentions it. The produce retains its sanctity, and therefore you're not allowed to destroy it. What that means is, you have to drink it to the end if you're dealing with wine. It means that if you process it, you have to process it in the normal way that it is processed. You're not allowed to destroy any part of it that is normally eaten. So what that means is you are allowed to cook with Shemitah Otzer based in wine. That's fine. However, if you have an Esrog that was an Otzer based in Esrog, and after Sukkos, you want to process it to make Esrog liqueur, so you have to be careful not to destroy any part of it in that process other than what you're doing normally to make the liqueur. If you use oats or based in wine for Havdalah, you're not supposed to overflow the cup, even though many people have the practice that at Havdalah, they overflow the kos. You can't do that if you're using oats or based in wine. Because it's considered to be wasted.
Do you have to wash out the bottle and then drink to get the last drops out and drink the water with a little bit of wine just to make sure you've cleared every last drop out?
So I read about this in the last Shemitah cycle, and I think the answer was no. I think the last drops that you can't get out are drops that are understood always to be just what's going to go, but I don't remember that for sure. I'd have to look that up. And then we get to the exporting question. Sorry? And then we get to the export question. Are you allowed to export Shemitah produce? So the truth of the matter is, there's a Mishnah that says you're not allowed to export Shemitah produce, and I brought that in the Rambam in source number 23. You are not allowed to export, and the reason why you're not allowed to export is because we want Israel to have its produce for people to be able to eat during the Shemitah year. If you take the produce out of the land, then you're damaging the supply that remains in Israel. So the truth is, Tosfos says you're allowed to export for commercial purposes. In general, you're allowed to do that. But in any case, once something is exported from Israel, we outside of Israel are allowed to eat it. That's the rule. So in other words, no, you're not supposed to export Shemitah produce. However, I am allowed to eat the Shemitah produce that is exported. However, there is a restriction. As the Rambam notes, based on the Yerushalmi in source number 25, Shemitah produce that has been exported from Israel may not be moved from place to place. I believe what we mean when we say place to place, that has to do with the law of Biur, which I'm going to get to now. And it's 11:29. If people have to leave, they can leave, but this is the last point. There is a halacha in Shemitah that produce at year end, when its season ends, has to be eliminated. Ramban explains that what that means is you make it hefker, take it out of your property and leave it out on the street. There's more to be said about this, obviously, but that's the short form, is take it out of your property, declare it ownerless, and then, as the Chazon Ish says, the next day you can come back and take it. So leave it out at the curb. And the next day, you can come back and take it for yourself. But you have to go through that biur process. The thing is that produce hits year end in different places. It depends on how it grows in that particular location. So number one, I'm not allowed to move it from one location to another. So if I buy Shemitah Otzer based in wine from the LCBO in Toronto, I am not allowed to then take that that wine, let's say, to the U.S., leave aside issues of importing it and how many bottles I'm allowed to bring, but I wouldn't be allowed to move it from place to place. That's number one. And then number two, when it reaches the particular date of Beor for wine, and that's a discussion as to what that date is, but it's not for right now. When it reaches that date, I have to take it out and leave it, leave it overnight in order that anybody should have the chance to take it. And then afterwards, if it survives that, then I'm able to take it back. But that will apply to oats or based in as well. So, to sum up, and normally I provide review questions, but here I figured each section had review questions already, so we're good. But this is a means of providing produce for the community, as well as, along the way, providing for, yes, the farmer, if we're able to hire the farmer, making sure that the community will pay for the work that was done, and at the same time, the community will have access to the tree fruit, as well as whatever stuff grew wildly that always grows wildly. That's the goal here. There are questions and limitations regarding hiring the worker, whether you can keep people out of the orchard as well, and what kind of rabbinical court is eligible to do this, all of which comes back to the question of how this works in the first place. Is the rabbinical court doing anything novel as the arm of the needy? Or is it simply a matter of saying, well, we're not acting as the owner? That's what determines whether you can hire the owner. That's what determines what kind of rabbinical court you need, whether you can keep people out. Fundamentally, the Beit Din is allowed to turn around and charge people for the work. They're not supposed to have a profit margin. They're not supposed to be elevating the price, although we understand that in the event that it costs more than in a normal year because of the nature of Shemitah, then yes, it may well end up costing more, and so be it, even though you'd say, well, you're not doing people a favor with this. Finally, the produce is still Shemitah produce. Therefore, there are those who argue it may not be weighed. Others argue that weighing it is fine because you're not weighing it for sale. You certainly have doubt about being able to sell it in a storefront. Maybe you're able to sell it, in a storefront, but not with other non-Shemitah produce. And because it retains its sanctity, you have to be careful about the money that's used for it. You should not pay cash. You should pay credit. Do it on credit. Be careful not to destroy the produce itself. Don't waste it. Don't move it from place to place outside of Israel either. And the law of Beor, of getting rid of it at year end or rendering it ownerless, is going to apply. Obviously, there's a lot more to discuss. This is just a primer. I hope it's a useful primer. I thank you very much for joining us, and I thank the Seder Boker Group again for dedicating our learning in honor of Rabbi Yaris. I know I saw people enter notes in the chat, even though I asked them not to. So, Bli Neder, afterwards, I will, for those who I have an email address for, I will respond to you by email. But for those who are anonymous, I can't really help you. Joyce.
There was one question, Rabbi.
Yeah.
For example, LCBO wines, weren't they purchased on credit?
So the LCBO, I don't know how the LCBO does its business, so I can't really answer that. But it won't affect...
So groceries and other fruit processing to Ontario goods, obviously in Israel is a different story, but that comes outside of Israel to Ontario, isn't it typically purchased?
Okay, but let's say it is. At the end of the day, that doesn't affect the end user transaction because the produce still has sanctity. And the issue is still the same that if I pay in cash, the cash gains the sanctity. The produce doesn't lose it, but the cash gains it. This is a type of sanctity that is not subject to Newtonian physics. So the Kedusha will grow and spread. So that's the problem, is I shouldn't provide them with cash that will not be treated with sanctity. So therefore, I still need to pay with credit, even if they bought it on credit. Them buying it on credit doesn't change that.
What about a debit card?
Sorry, what, Avram?
A debit card.
A debit card. So a debit card is interesting, because then you don't have the advantage of the money being taken to pay a debt. The money is subtracted and sent to them right now. The only question is whether the fact that it's digital, and therefore there's nothing to point to have that kedusha, maybe that would help. I would need to look into that question. It's an interesting one. But credit will definitely be better than debit, because in credit, it's being paid as a debt, whereas in debit, it's actually being paid right now. Again, the virtual character of it may be helpful. Okay.
Rabbi?
Yes, Albert.
Just thinking, the last couple of weeks we've been reading
talking about Joseph and how distribution of food was handled in Egypt. Why wasn't something like this just taken over? I mean, why go through all this system?
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, in order to distribute food during the famine, all the food was taken into the storerooms of Egypt or the pharaoh.
Right.
And then distributed to the people who came and needed it and paid for it.
Correct.
So then why not do the same thing in this case?
So you are. You are doing that. The only thing that we're adding here, and I don't know how they manage this part of it in Egypt, but the only thing that we're doing here is making sure that the farmer is going to commit to this, because the farmer knows she's going to be paid for the work that she did in order to provide the produce.
There's a getter.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you, Denny.
The getter is open, not closed.
Yes. Okay, well, thank you all very, very much for participating. Shkoyach to you.